Osho, The Secret of Secrets, Volume 1, Talks on the Secret of the Golden Flower, Discourse Number 6, given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India.
The first question. Why is it so difficult to enjoy? Rani, it is difficult to enjoy because you will have to disappear. Joy is possible if you are not. You and joy cannot coexist. When joy is there, you are absent. When you are there, joy is absent. They are like light and darkness. They can't exist together in the same place. Hence, to enjoy is difficult. It is not easy. Because to die is difficult. To die is not easy. And only those who know how to die moment to moment know how to enjoy. The more capable you are of dying, the deeper will be your joy. Intense will be the flame of it. And great will be the flowering of it. It is also difficult, Rani, to enjoy because you have so many investments in remaining miserable. Unless you see it, you can go on trying to enjoy, but you will never enjoy. Those investments in the misery have to be dropped. And from the very childhood, everybody learns that misery pays. If you are miserable, the parents are more loving. If you are ill, the parents are more caring. If you are happy, healthy, nobody cares. You don't get attention. And attention is food for the ego. Without the attention, the ego cannot live. It is its very breath. Just as the body needs oxygen, the ego needs attention. Whenever you are healthy, happy, the parents don't pay any attention to you, there is no need. But when you are ill, miserable, crying, weeping, the whole family becomes attentive to your needs. As if you have created a kind of emergency. They drop all their work. The mother runs from the kitchen, the father drops his newspaper, and everybody is focused on you. It gives you great ego fulfillment. And slowly, slowly you learn the way of the ego. Remain miserable. And people will pay attention to you. Remain miserable and they will sympathize with you. And whenever you are enjoying, nobody sympathizes with you. That's why people pay so much respect to ascetic people. Somebody is fasting, and people say, look, what a great saint. He is simply being miserable. If you are feasting, nobody is going to sympathize with you. But fast and people sympathize. If you are in love with a woman, who is going to sympathize with you? People will be jealous on the contrary. You are a competitor. They wanted the same woman themselves. You are an enemy. Renounce sex. Become celibate. Move to a cave and people will come from faraway places to pay respects. Here is a great ascetic. And you are simply being miserable. But misery pays. Misery can make you a Mahatma. That has been the whole history of humanity. Misery has always paid. You have expected miserable people. And if the misery is self-inflicted, of course, you gain more respect. It is voluntary. Mahatma Gandhi became such a great name in the world because he was voluntarily miserable, inflicting misery upon himself. How can you be not attentive to him? If he was enjoying and living a total life, a whole and healthy life, you would have been jealous. You would have been antagonistic. See these tricks and strategies of the mind, and you will be able to drop them. Don't ask for attention, otherwise you will remain miserable. Attention can only be given when you are miserable. That is part of a natural mechanism. It happens in your body too. If you have a headache, your attention moves to the head. You forget the whole body. If you have a pain in the leg, then the whole attention moves towards the leg. You forget the whole body. Then the leg becomes very important. It is good that legs and head and hands, they are not politicians. Otherwise they will constantly be in pain. They will remain constantly in pain. It is good that they don't have any egos. If the leg had some kind of ego, then the leg will continuously create trouble. Because only when there is trouble, you pay attention. You massage the leg. You take care of it. This is inner mechanism too. Attention goes to the part which is in pain. And this is the mechanism of the family, of the society, of the whole world at large. Once you have learned the trick, it becomes unconscious. It becomes autonomous. You simply go on using the trick. The husband comes home and the wife immediately starts being miserable. This I have watched. I used to stay in many families when I was traveling around this country. The wife was laughing and was happy, and suddenly the husband comes and I am watching. And her face changes. Not that she is doing it. No, it is not needed to do anymore. It is autonomous. Seeing the husband coming, seeing the key move in the hole, suddenly an automatic change happens in her. Her face becomes miserable because the husband will pay attention only to her if she is in misery. otherwise not. This mechanism has to be made conscious. Watch out for it. Otherwise, it will destroy all possibilities of joy in life. It has destroyed. Millions of people live in misery and hell because they hanker for attention. It is stupid to hanker for attention. It does not give you anything. It only strengthens the ego, which is not you. It is not your essence. It is only your personality, your pseudo-self. It goes on nursing the pseudo-self, and the essential self goes on starving. The essential self need not have any attention. The essential self can live without any attention because it is not dependent on anybody else. And the essential self is capable of rejoicing in its aloneness. It does not need even the other. So what to say about attention? It does not need even the other. Its bliss is inner. It does not come from the outside. It does not depend on any condition. It is unconditional. It is a spontaneous, inner, intrinsic phenomenon. Watch and see how you are profiting out of misery, and then you will know why it is so difficult to enjoy. And stop these investments in misery, and the joy will flow again. We are born with joy. Joy is our very being. It does not need anything to be joyous. One can simply be joyous sitting by himself. Joy is natural. Misery is unnatural. But misery is profitable. And joy is purposeless. It will not bring you any profit. So one has to decide. If you want to be joyous, you have to be a nobody. This is the decision. If you want to be joyous, you have to be a nobody, because you will not get any attention. On the contrary, people will feel jealous. People will be antagonistic to you. People will not like you. People will like you only if you are in misery, then they will sympathize. In sympathy, your ego is fulfilled and their ego is fulfilled. Whenever they sympathize with somebody, they are higher and you are lower. They have an upper hand. They are enjoying the trip of sympathy. Sympathy is violent. They are seeing the fact that you are miserable and they are not. They are in a position to sympathize, and you are in a position to be sympathized with. Their ego is fulfilled and your ego is fulfilled, because look, you say to yourself, how much important you are. Everybody is sympathizing with you. So ego fulfills from both the sides. It is profitable. Nobody is in a loss. When you are joyous, rejoicing, dancing, singing, just being happy for no reason at all, your ego will disappear because it will not get attention. and others will not feel good because you will not give them an opportunity to fulfill their egos. That's the reason why people were against Jesus and against Buddha, and why they are against me. They would like me also to be an ascetic. They would like me also to be fasting, living under a tree like a beggar. Then they will be very happy. They will come in thousands. They will worship me. But if I live in my own way, and my way is the way of the feast, my way is the way of festivity, then they are shocked. They were perfectly happy. If somebody leaves the palace and becomes a beggar, they are perfectly happy. They love the man. But if a beggar moves into the palace, they will all will be against him. They will not like the idea at all. Just watch, you also do such things. If a man is lying on a bed of thorns, immediately you prostrate, as if he is doing something great, as if he is bringing some blessing to the humanity. He is being just a messagist. But you love, you respect. Your respect seems to be morbid. Your respect seems to be ill, sick. And because of your respect, he is lying there on the thorns. He wants your attention. And this is the most simple way to get your attention and your respect. His ego is fulfilled. He is ready to lie down on those thorns and suffer. This thing is happening in smaller scales, bigger scales, everywhere. Beware of it. It is a very ancient trap. And then you can enjoy. Then there is nothing else but to enjoy. If you are ready to become a nobody, if you are not in need of others' attention, there is no problem at all. You can enjoy. Any small things you can enjoy. Very small things can give you the greatest joy possible. Just see Jesus with his friends eating, drinking. People could not tolerate it. They would have loved him if he was an ascetic. But he was not. One day he comes into a town, and Mary Magdalene came for the first time to see this man. And she fell in love with this man. This man was worth loving. How can you avoid? How can you manage not to fall in love with such a man? She brought very precious perfume. and poured it on Jesus' feet and washed Jesus' feet with that precious perfume. And she was crying in joy. And Judas said to Jesus, "This is wrong. You should have prevented the woman. The perfume was very precious. It could have been sold. It could have fed few poor people in the town." Now with whom you are going to agree, with Judas or Jesus? If you are honest, you will agree with Judas. If you are honest with yourself, you will agree with Judas. He seems to be the beginning of socialism, communism, Gandhiism. He seems to be very logically right. He was the most intellectual disciple of Jesus, the only educated disciple of Jesus, and his logic is flawless. But what Jesus said something absurd. He said, "You can feed the poor when I am gone. Poor will be always there. You need not worry. But while I am here, rejoice." Do you agree with Jesus? If you agree, you can be joyous. If you don't agree, you are going to remain miserable. But look, your head will say, "Judas seems to be right." Jesus seems to be utterly absurd. What he is saying, that the poor will always be there. But right now, you are with the bridegroom. You enjoy. You celebrate. This is celebration. Now, if the people were against Jesus, it seems to be absolutely fitting with our so-called intellect. Jesus says, "I cannot prevent the woman because she is in such joy. I cannot destroy her joy. Look at her tears. Look at her being. She is in such a festive mood. This is just symbolic. This pouring of the precious perfume on my feet is just symbolic. That she is utterly happy. She is celebrating. I cannot stop anybody from celebration." Then, if you agree with Jesus, you can be joyous. So it depends on you, Rani, whether you agree with Judas or you agree with Jesus. The second question: you had no master. No Buddha had a master. Sometimes I think that choosing a master means to prevent one's own enlightenment. I mean the need of the own way, the impossibility of guidance. Please tell me what you mean. Andreas, I never asked any such question to anybody. To ask the question is to search for guidance, is to seek for guidance. A question is always a need for for the answer from somebody else. If you have questions to ask, you will have to choose a master. A master is one who is ready to answer you. A disciple is one who is not only asking by curiosity, but is ready to stake his whole being on his questioning, is ready to transform his life according to the answer given. If you really ask the question, you have already become a disciple. That is the meaning of a disciple, to ask. Jesus says, ask and it shall be given you. Knock and the door shall be opened unto you. Seek and ye shall find. Ask and it shall be given unto you. Asking is the beginning of disciplehood. And unless you are a disciple, the master will not take much note of you. Because many come just as curiosity seekers. Out of curiosity, but not really ready to inquire. Inquiry needs commitment. Inquiry needs involvement. Inquiry is risky, dangerous. It is not only intellectual, it is existential. So if you really want to ask, remember, let me make you alert, you are already becoming a disciple. And if you think that to choose a master is to prevent one's enlightenment, please don't ask questions. And I was surprised, because Andreas has asked at least 7 questions today. The largest number of questions is from him. Secondly, you say you had no master. That is true. I had no master. That does not mean that I was not a disciple. I accepted the whole existence as my master. It needs more courage to accept the whole existence as your master. If you cannot accept even a single man as your master, how can you accept the whole existence as your master? The trees and the rocks and the rivers and the clouds. If you cannot love a single human being, how can you love the whole? It is true, I had no master. But that does not mean that I was not a disciple. My disciplehood was a greater involvement than your disciplehood is. I trusted the clouds, which is very difficult. I trusted the trees, which is almost impossible. I trusted existence as such. If that is possible, then you need not have any master in particular, because then everything is your master. When a great Sufi mystic, Hassan, was dying, somebody asked Hassan, who was your master? He said, now it is too late to ask. Time is short, I am dying. But the inquirer asks, you can simply say the name. You are still alive, you are still breathing and talking. You can simply tell me the name. And he said, it will be difficult because I had thousands of masters. If I just relate their names, it will take months and years. It is too late. But two masters I will certainly tell you about. One was a thief. Once I got lost into the desert, and when I reached into the village, it was very late. Half the night was already gone. Shops were closed. Caravanserais were closed. There was not a single human being on the roads. I searched somebody to inquire. I found one man who was trying to make a hole in a house wall. I asked him where I can stay. And he said, I am a thief and you look me to be a Sufi mystic. His robe, his aura. And the thief said, right now it will be very difficult to find any place to stay, but you can come to my home. You can stay with me. If you can stay with a thief. Hassan said, I hesitated a little bit. Then I suddenly remembered, if the thief is not afraid of a Sufi, then why the Sufi should be afraid of a thief? In fact, he should be afraid of me. So I said, yes, I will come. And I went and I stayed with the thief, and the man was so lovely, so beautiful. I stayed for 1 month. And each night he will say to me, now I am going for my work. You rest. You pray. You do your work. And when he will come, I will ask, could you get anything? He said, not tonight. But tomorrow I will try again. And he was never in a state of hopelessness. For 1 month continuously, he came empty-handed. But he was always happy and he said, I will try tomorrow. God willing, tomorrow it is going to happen. And you also pray for me. At least you can say to God, help this poor man. And then Hassan said, when I was meditating and meditating for years on and nothing was happening, and many times the moment came, I was so desperate, so hopeless, that I thought to stop all this nonsense. There is no God, and all prayer is just madness, and all meditation is false, and suddenly I will remember the thief who will say every night, God willing, tomorrow it is going to happen. So I tried one day more. If the thief was so hopeful, with such hope and trust, I should try at least one day more. And many times it happened, but the thief and his memory helped me to wait one day more. And one day it happened. It did happen. I bowed down. I was thousands of miles away from the thief and his house. But I bowed down in his direction. He was my first master. And my second master was a dog. I was thirsty. And I was going towards the river. And a dog came. He was also thirsty. He looked into the river. He saw another dog there, his own image. He became afraid. He barked, and the other dog barked too. But his thirst was so much, he hesitated. He will go back and will come again and will look into the water and will find the dog there. But the thirst was so much that he suddenly jumped into the water and the image disappeared. He drank the water. He swam in the water. It was hot summer and I was watching. And I knew that a message has come to me from God. One has to jump in spite of all fears. When I was on the verge of jumping into the unknown, the same fear was there. I will go to the very edge, hesitate and come back. And I will remember the dog. If the dog could manage, why can't I? And then one day I jumped into the unknown. I disappeared and only the unknown was left behind. The dog was my second master. And the third master was a small child. I entered into a town and a small child was bringing a candle, lit candle, hiding in his hands and going to the mosque to put the candle there. Just jokingly I asked the boy, "Have you lit the candle yourself?" He said, "Yes, sir." And I asked jokingly, "Can you tell me from where the light came?" There was a moment the candle was unlit. Then there was a moment the candle was lit. "Can you show me the source from where the light came?" "And you have lit it, so you must have seen light coming from where?" And the boy laughed and blew off the candle and said, "Now you have seen light going where it has gone. You tell me." And my ego was shattered. And my whole knowledge was shattered. And that moment, I felt my own stupidity. Since then, I dropped all knowledgeability. Hassan talked about three masters. And he said, there have been many. And it is not left for me. No time is left for me to talk about them all. Yes, this is true. I had no master because I had millions of masters. I have learned from every possible source. If you can be that kind of a disciple, you need not have a master. But remember, it is not that you are not having a master. Either you choose one or you choose all. But in any case, you have to be a disciple. To be a disciple is a must on the path. What does it mean to be a disciple? It means to be able to learn, to be available to learn, to be vulnerable to existence. What actually happens when you choose a master? You start learning how to learn. And with one master, slowly, slowly you get into tune and slowly, slowly you see the point that the same way you can get in tune with the whole existence. The master is just a miniature of the whole. Coming closer to the master, you start becoming aware of the beatitudes, of the closeness, of love, of intimacy, of involvement, of commitment. And slowly, slowly you see the point, if just being so close to one single person can be of such tremendous joy, how much more it will be when you will be close to the whole. The master is just the beginning. The master is not the end. And the true master is only a door. Through him you pass and go beyond. And the true master helps you to go beyond him. You say you had no masters. No Buddha had a master. Sometimes I think that choosing a master means to prevent one's own enlightenment. Enlightenment is simply enlightenment. It is neither mine nor yours. The ego is separate. The essence is not separate. To think in terms of your own enlightenment is to be caught in the net, in the trap of the ego again. You miss the whole point. If you think your own enlightenment, just as you think your own car, your own house, your own wife, you start thinking of enlightenment also as something that you will possess. You will not be there to possess it. You will be possessed by it. And to surrender to a master simply means an experiment in being possessed by somebody. You drop yourself and the other enters in you and fills you. You learn surrender. It is just ABC of surrender. But you cannot learn X, Y, Z if you have not learned even ABC of it. When you go to learn swimming, you don't go directly to the ocean. You don't go to deep waters. You learn in shallow water on the bank. Or you learn in a swimming pool. The master is like a swimming pool where you can learn how to swim. Once you have learned, all the oceans are yours. Then you can go anywhere. Then this whole existence belongs to you. But you are no more there. In fact, it will be better to say you belong to the whole existence. Not that you possess enlightenment. Enlightenment possesses you. Sometimes I think that choosing a master means to prevent one's own enlightenment. You don't have a master yet, then who has prevented you from becoming enlightened? Why you are not enlightened yet? If choosing a master prevents people, then those who don't have masters must be enlightened. Choosing the master does not prevent enlightenment. Getting caught by the master, getting caught into the master prevents enlightenment. And these are two different things. That's why Buddha says, if you meet me on the way, kill me immediately. And I say to you too, if you see me on the way, kill me immediately. The master is a ladder. You have to use it and you have to go beyond it. The master is a boat. You have to use it, and when you have reached the other shore, you have to leave the boat. You need not carry it on your heads. If you carry it on your heads, you are stupid. And you have not reached anywhere. You must be dreaming. Because such stupid people never reach to the other source. Choosing the master does not prevent. But a moment comes when you have to go beyond the master. Then don't cling. Clinging to the master prevents. But if there is a real master, he will not allow you to cling to him. That is the definition of a real master. He teaches you to get involved. He teaches you to become committed. And one day he teaches you to become uncommitted again, to become uninvolved again. Then the master is perfect. The ordinary so-called masters just teach you one thing, how to become attached to them and then remain attached to them. That's the definition of a pseudo-master. Avoid the pseudo-masters. But to find a true master is not going to prevent your enlightenment. You will not become enlightened without it. It is a paradoxical phenomenon. You have to choose the master and you have to go beyond the master. If you understand this paradox, my answer will be clear to you. The third question, I want to conquer the kingdom of God. How to do it? God cannot be conquered. The very idea is foolish. You have to be conquered by God. You have to allow God to conquer you. On the contrary, you are saying, I want to conquer the kingdom of God. This is the male ego, the aggressive mind. It always thinks in terms of conquering. Conquer nature. Conquer God. Conquer love. And you have destroyed everything that you have conquered. You have destroyed the beauty of nature, the ecology, the inner harmony of nature by your conquering it. Even a man like Bertrand Russell writes a book, Conquest of Nature. But this is how the Western mind has been thinking continuously in terms of conquering. Either conquer this world or conquer that world, but you remain an Alexander. This is not the way to approach love. This is not the way to pray. The very word conquering is ugly. Surrendering. Letting God conquer you. Allowing Him to enter you. Don't prevent Him. You need not go. You need not go in search of Him. You need not become a soldier to conquer. That's the difference between a soldier and a sannyasin. The soldier wants to conquer, the sannyasin wants to be conquered. There was a loud hammering on the door to heaven. Saint Peter appeared and said, I say, that's a tremendous racket. Who is making all the fuss? The savvy man standing there said, I am Paddy McGuinness, and I am strong with the IRA these 30 years. St. Peter said, I am sorry, Mr. McGuinness, but we have no record of you. You can't come in. And who is saying anything about coming in? Said Paddy, I am here telling you, you have got 15 minutes to evacuate the place. This is the meaning of conquering gods and the kingdom of gods. Drop this whole mind. This mind won't allow you. This mind is irreverent. This mind is incapable of knowing what worship is, what prayer is. Be a little more aware, alert, what you are asking. Do you want to possess God in your hands? Do you want the God to be in your bank balance? God is not a treasure to be put in the bank. And God is not a thing that you can hold in your fist. God is not a thing. God is not a property. Remember not to use the words that you use in your ordinary ego trips. Those words will mislead you. These words show your ambitiousness. These words are political. These words are not religious. A religious person surrenders. He prays. He waits. He opens up his being. He trusts. He says to God, Thy kingdom come, Thy will be done. He prays, let me be destroyed utterly, completely. So there is no hindrance left. Let me be absolutely empty, so you can come and fill me totally. The fourth question. My Orthodox Christian parents think that you are a dangerous sophist and some wicked force is working through you to destroy religion. Why do they think like that? It is nothing new. It has always been so. It has nothing to do with Christians. This is so with Hindus, this is so with Buddhists, and this has always been so. They were thinking in the same way about Christ too. These are the same people. They were thinking in the same way about Buddha too, and these are the same people. Man is a very strange animal. The most strange thing about man is that it never learns. It goes on doing the same thing again and again. Why they crucified Jesus? What was wrong with this man? They thought him wicked. They thought him a representative of evil, a personification of devil. They were angry. And of course, the people who were interested in Jesus were younger people. Because only young people can be interested in the new. The old generation has too much investment with the established. Too much involved with the status quo. Do you think Jesus' followers were old people? He was himself young. And the people that surrounded him were young people. Parents were angry. Very angry. Rabbis were angry. Priests were angry. Because he was bringing a revolution. If Jesus is right, then the whole established religion is wrong. If Jesus is right, then what about the priests? Jesus and the priests can't be both right together. Either Jesus or the priests. The priests became organized against this man. They had to kill him. And the older generation was with them, naturally. The mind always feels comfortable with the old, because it is familiar. One is accustomed of it. The new always feels dangerous, suspicious. One feels about it. And religion is always new. True religion is always new. True religion is always rebellious. Whenever there is a man like Jesus or Buddha, there is bound to be great trouble. But Jesus is crucified, and then slowly, Jesus' life becomes the foundation of a new established religion. Once Christianity becomes established religion, supported by the state and supported by the elders, and Christianity itself has its own priesthood, then there is no problem. Then if a man like me comes, problems arise. You say my Orthodox Christian parents think that you are a dangerous sophist and some wicked force is working through you to destroy religion. In a way, they are true. What they call religion is not religion, and I am certainly in favor to destroy it. What I call religion, they cannot understand. It is impossible for them to conceive. They have become too much stereotyped in their thinking. Their minds are too much conditioned, fixed. They are no more fluid, flexible. They are rigid. The older a person becomes, the more rigid he becomes. Let me tell you a few things that were said about Christians in the early days of Christianity, and then you will understand what your parents are saying about me. Tacitus says, there is a group hated for their abominations called Christians. And Suetonius says, the Christians are a class of men given to a new and wicked superstition. And Celsus says, they worship to an extravagant degree this man who appeared recently. They are like frogs holding a symposium round a swamp, debating which of them is the most sinful. And Lucian says, the poor wretches have convinced themselves that they are going to be immortal and live for all time by worshipping that crucified sophist and living under his laws. They receive their doctrines by tradition without any definite evidence. And Pliny the Younger says, it is their habit on a fixed day to assemble before daylight and recite by turns a form of words to Christ as a God. The contagion of this perverse and extravagant superstition has penetrated not the cities only, but the villages and the country too. Yet it seems possible to stop it and set it right. These things are not said about me. These things are said about Christ. And similar things have been said about Buddha. Hindus have created a beautiful story about Buddha. They say that he was an incarnation of God. They had to say it. Hindus are more polite and of course more cunning, more sophisticated. And they know how to play with words. Buddha was an incarnation of God, they say. But not a good incarnation. But how can a God's incarnation be bad? They have a beautiful story to illustrate it. They say, when God created the world, he created hell and heaven and earth, the three worlds. Then millions of years passed and nobody went to hell. It remained empty. And the devil was very angry. And all his disciples. And they were waiting and waiting and nobody will come. And every arrangement was ready. The fire was burning. And nobody is coming. Finally they had to go to God. And the devil said, this is nonsense. Why you created hell if nobody is going to come there? And what we are doing there? Just waiting and waiting. And how long we have to wait? Not even a single soul has entered. The whole thing is pointless. Either send few people so we become occupied, and we have rehearsals, and we have trained ourselves and skilled ourselves so much that we are hankering. We have to do something. You are driving us mad. Either send few people there or drop the whole project. God said, you wait. Then I will have to come to the earth. I will be born as Gautam the Buddha. And I will mislead people and misguide people. Then they will start falling into hell automatically. Then God came as Gautam the Buddha, and he misguided people, because the hell needs people. And once Buddha misguided people, hell has been overcrowded. Now see the beauty of the story and the cunningness of it. Buddha is accepted as an incarnation of God, but it is just to send people to hell. So beware of Buddha. Don't follow him, otherwise you will go to hell. Buddha was here to help the devil, to give him some occupation. Since then, hell is overcrowded. There is no space. People have to wait for years outside the gates. This has been always so, and this is going to remain to be so. Religion, whenever it comes fresh from the beyond, is very shattering to the tradition, and the traditional people become afraid. Not that they are worried about religion being destroyed. They are not religious at all, otherwise they will not be afraid of it. Their religion is only a social formality. They talk about God because it is convenient to talk about God. They go to the church too because it makes things easier. The church functions as a lubricant. It is a Sunday religion. It is good. It keeps you in good company. And everybody knows that you are religious. That helps in many ways. The church is not more than a Rotary Club or a Lions Club. If you are a Rotarian, it helps you. People know that you must be good. You belong to the Rotary Club. And in the Rotary Club you become acquainted of all the topmost people of the town. Friendship arises. It helps in your business, in your day-to-day life. The church is nothing but a kind of religious club. It is convenient. Nobody is sincerely there. People are just showing respect to Christ, paying service, but that service is lip service. They don't bother a bit about Christ, Christianity, and all his teachings. Who bothers about Christ's teachings? Who follows? If you follow Christ, the world would have been totally different. There would not have been any wars. And half of the world is Christian. If Christians really follow Jesus, and Jesus says, love your enemies, and Christians go on bombing the enemy. It is Christians who bombed Japan, who used the first atomic bomb. Now think of Jesus watching from his place. What will be happening to him? Christians dropping atom bombs. And he has said to these people, love your enemy as yourself. Who has followed Jesus? There is no question of following. People just go to the church. It is a good feeling to go to the church to remain religious. I have heard the airplane was going through some especially turbulent weather, but the pilot knew he had everything under control. He tried to calm the passengers with soothing words spoken over the loudspeaker system. He also asked the stewardesses to reassure the people that everything would be all right. One very religious little old lady, however, would not be comforted. The stewardess told her how capable the pilot was and how reliable the plane's technology was, but the woman was still sure she would never see the ground again. At last, the stewardess finally called on the highest court of appeal. "Just trust in Providence," she said soothingly. The little old lady's eyes opened even wider. "Is it as bad as that?" she asked. A religious old lady. But to think of God really means death is certain. Is it as bad as that? People have double faces. Their original face is not even known to themselves. People have split personalities. Your parents will be thinking they are Christians and religious. They are neither Christians nor religious. If they are really religious, they will understand me. Because whatsoever I am saying is the same, exactly the same, precisely the same. My language may be different from Jesus, it has to be. 20 centuries have passed. But what I am doing is exactly the same work, the continuity of the same work. But I can understand their problem too. They are losing hold on you and they are afraid. Just the other night I was reading an article in Germany. The parents have made a certain society to prevent young people going into new religions, particularly the Eastern mystic experiences. In America, they are creating a lot of trouble for the young people. You will be surprised that parents are hiring kidnappers . Young people are being kidnapped by their own parents and then they are being given to psychologists. Certain psychologists are trying to deprogram them. They are called deprogrammers. They think they have been conditioned. For example, if you really become too much involved with me and your parents become very much afraid and you don't want to go back to your country, you can be kidnapped. Your own parents can do it for your own sake. Because you have fallen in the trap of a devil, of some evil force. And it looks to them, what you are doing with orange clothes and beard and long hairs and the mala. And who is this man, very evil looking? And what is wrong with having a cross, having the picture of Jesus? What you are doing here? And if they come and see the dynamic meditation, Kundalini, they will go crazy. They will become very much concerned. Yes, you can be kidnapped. And then you can be forced, what they call deprogramming, to uncondition you. They think you have been hypnotized. So you have to be dehypnotized. So they will teach you again Christianity and the Christian catechism. And they will force you day in, day out for months so that you can again become a Christian. And you can again say, yes, I believe in God and the Son and the Holy Ghost. And then they are at ease. When you believe in the Holy Ghost, then all is okay. And when you start reading the Bible again, all is okay. Now, you have come back. You have become religious. When you start making atom bombs again, you are real Christian, Catholic. When you go to the army and they cut your long hairs and make you a soldier, then you are a perfect Christian, a Catholic. When you start a cutthroat competition in the world for money, for power, for prestige, when you start destroying others so that you can reach higher and higher in worldly possessions, you are perfect. You are a religious person. Even politicians are thought to be religious persons because they go to the church. They listen to the sermon of the priest. Politicians are religious. And my sannyasins are not religious. You will have to understand it. You will have to be very, very patient with your parents. You will have to be very kind too. They need compassion. They are encaged in a certain ideology and they cannot look outside it. They are incapable of feeling anything new, of being anything new. They are incapable of understanding. They have become too rigid. Their whole ideology has become a settled phenomenon, and they are afraid. If they see you happy, they can only think you have gone mad, because they have lived an unhappy life and a very religious life. And they know religious people are unhappy people, sad, with long faces. They cannot believe that you can be religious and dancing, and you can be religious and laughing, and you can be religious and yet happy. Then what about all their saints? Were they fools? They lived with long faces their whole life. They carried their life like a burden, as if a mountain is being carried on their heads. And you are so light-footed, so weightless, with no burden, with no seriousness around you. You are such a laughter. How can they believe you are religious? The only thing possible is you have been hypnotized. How can you be so happy in such an unhappy world? It is not possible. You must be living in a kind of illusion. Hence they say that this man is an evil force. He has hypnotized you. The laughter that you are going through is false. The joy that you are experiencing is false. Their misery is right and true, and your joy is false. When they will be able to make you miserable again, they will be at ease. Their son has come back home, or their daughter has come back home. You will have to be understanding. They cannot understand me, they cannot understand you, but they are your parents and you owe something to them. Be loving to them. Don't be antagonistic. Don't resent. Don't start arguing and fighting with them. Because that will make them more convinced that they are right and you are wrong. Be more loving. Nobody has loved them. They have lived in a false world where all are pretensions. Nobody has loved them. If you love them, it will be more convincing than logic. Listen to them. Don't start arguing. Listen patiently. Nobody has ever listened to them. That's why psychoanalysis has become so important in the world. Psychoanalysis is nothing but just finding a patient listener, the psychoanalyst, whom you can talk to your heart's content, and whatsoever you want, sense, nonsense, whatsoever you want. People are feeling suffocated, boiling within. They want to say something, but nobody is there to hear. The world has turned deaf. The man cannot talk to his woman, because the moment you talk, conflict starts. You say something, she understands something else. The woman cannot talk to the man because talking is always risky. It is better to keep quiet and to remain silent. At least it gives you a feeling of peace that all is quiet. Say a single word and the argument starts. Sooner or later people learn that it is better to remain silent, not to say anything. Nobody has listened to them. Just see the misery of the fact that they have to go and find a person to listen, but they have to pay for it. And the costs are really very high. Psychoanalysis is one of the highly paying profession. It is a Jewish concern. And Jews know how to do business. Freud founded the greatest empire. And his followers are just looting. Just enjoying. And what they are doing, they simply listen. No other help is needed. If you listen to the person for months together, years together, he loses the esteem. And once he has thrown his esteem out, he feels calm and quiet. And he thinks this is because of psychoanalysis. It is not because of psychoanalysis. In older societies, more primitive societies, this is not needed because people are very willing to listen. Go to an Indian village. People are very willing to listen. They have enough time to listen. Nobody is in a hurry. People are sitting and talking and listening to each other. You cannot convince Indian villagers that there is any need for psychoanalysis. They are doing psychoanalysis to each other already. They need not pay for it. But in a highly sophisticated, cultured, civilized society, people are in such a hurry. Nobody is available to talk to anybody else. Parents never see their children. Or even if they see, then just polite words, hello, how you are, and they are gone. Or a pat on the head, which is almost mechanical. Or a hug, which is false. Or even a kiss, which is just an empty gesture. But nobody talks. Nobody faces each other. There is no friendship, no love. Parents live in one world, the children live in another. Parents are so much suffocated with their own misery, helplessness, turmoil, that they have to drown themselves in alcohol. Children are getting drowned into drugs. And the strange thing is that the people who drown themselves in alcohol are very much against drugs. And they are doing the same thing. It is not different. It is the same thing. Somehow to drown oneself, to forget all about oneself and the world and the problems. Even children are having so many problems because we teach them competition, ambition, we send them into the school and the competition starts. You have to be the first. You have to bring the A grade. Now you have made them answers. They are continuously in turmoil, anxiety, whether they will be able to make it or not. Small children are having ulcers. Young people are having heart attacks. Young people are going mad, committing suicide. This has not happened ever. Or if you don't want to commit suicide, you don't want to go mad, you don't want to have ulcers, cancer, heart attacks, then drown yourself into drugs. But then the state is against, then the society is against, and you feel guilty, and you are doing something illegal. You are a criminal. They will throw you into jail. The only possibility to get out of this whole nonsense is to find a new space in your being through prayer, through meditation. To find your original source of life and energy. And that's what you are doing here with me. If you really go into meditation, you will not need alcohol, you will not need drugs. If you really go into meditation, your life will be a life of love, of sharing, of joy, non-competitive, non-ambitious. You will not become politicians. You will live as a nobody. You will not suffer from inferiority complex, because you will not compare yourself with anybody else. And you will live in great gratitude, because your life will have joy. And you will not be attached to misery, because you will not have any investment in misery. If you don't have any ego, you need not have any investment in misery. Then you can feast, and your life can be a festival. That's what I am teaching here. And to me, this is religion, to make a life a feast, a festival. To transform energy in such a way that you become a celebration. But your parents will find it difficult. Help them to understand. Be loving. Patiently listen to their arguments. And don't argue. Rather, love. Just so, by your being, by your integrity, by your patience, by your caring about them, that you are moving on the right path. It is up to you. If you can prove by your love that you are moving on the right path, then only they will think that the man you are with is not evil. If you argue and fight and become antagonistic, which seems to be very natural, because they will be antagonistic and in a fighting mood, and the natural reaction is to be the same, tit for tat, if you do that, then you will be proving that your master is evil, and you will be proving that you have moved on a wrong path. What I am going to be proved in the world depends on you. The last question. Cannot sex be transcended without going into it? Then what is the need of transcending it? The need of transcendence arises only because you are in it. You are born in it. You are born out of it. You are a sexual phenomenon. Except Jesus. Nobody is born out of a virgin. And Christians insist too much on the theory that Mary was a virgin, so that they can condemn sex. If Jesus is also out of sex, then it will be difficult to condemn sex. In fact, Jesus is born out of sex as anybody else. The body has to be constituted by male and female energy. Otherwise, the body cannot be constituted. To say that Mary was virgin is to say that you have electricity in your house with only one pole, positive or negative. That will be as nonsensical. Electricity needs to have both the poles, positive and negative. Without those two poles, electricity cannot exist, cannot come into existence. Not even in Jesus' house. The electricity will need two poles. The electricity does not care who you are. Even in my house, it needs two poles. You can ask Haridas. He tries, the whole day he tries, continuously working to make electricity virgin. But up to now he has not succeeded. But later on you can write stories about me, that in Bhagwan's house the electricity had only one pole. These stories are always created later on, because you have to prove that your master was exceptional. Jainas say that Mahavira never perspired. Now what kind of foolishness? He missed the joy of perspiring in the sun. And he lived naked and moved naked. In fact, he must have perspired more than anybody else. If you say, I don't perspire, it may be right because I live in air conditioning. But Mahavira, moving naked, never perspires, something seems to be suspicious, fishy. Either he must have been stinking. To hide the fact, you have to cover it, that he never perspired. So the whole route is cut. He never defecated, never urinated. How can you think Mahavira pissing? That looks not right at all. These stories are created. These stories simply prove that followers are stupid. They don't say anything about Mahavira or Christ or Muhammad. They simply prove that the followers that come in the wake are neurotic. Jesus was born out of two sexes, as everybody is born. You come out of sex. Your each cell of the body is a sexual cell. Your each cell of the body has the two poles, the feminine and the masculine, the yin and yang. You ask me, cannot sex be transcended without going into it? The only possibility was if you were not born. If you are born, you have already become a sexual being. Whether you make love to a woman or man doesn't matter. You can be a celibate, but to be a celibate does not mean to go beyond sexuality. Sexuality has already penetrated. The moment you were in the womb of your mother, you have become a sexual being. There is no way to avoid it. So, all that you can do is repress it. You will become unnatural. And your whole life will be a perverted life. Repression is possible, but transcendence is not possible the way you are asking. I have heard Ellen and Dolph had been married 30 years and never missed a night of connubial bliss. One day Ellen visited her doctor and was told that she must have complete rest and quiet for 6 months or she would not live. Ellen and Dolph decided this would stay completely apart during this period. She moved into an upstairs bedroom and he remained downstairs. After 3 months of complete abstinence and solitude, his willpower collapsed and Dolph started for her bedroom. As he started to climb the stairs, he saw her coming down. Dear, she said, I was just coming down to die. I am glad, honey, he said, because I was just going up to kill you. Don't be mad. Let things be simple. There is no need to kill or die. Repression will make things very complicated in your life. You will become split, schizophrenic. Just on the surface, the celibate, and deep down, just the opposite of it. Transcendence means disappearance of the need of the other. Disappearance of the desire to get lost into a woman or into a man. And this is possible only if you have understood. And understanding comes only through experience. So I don't say drop out of your relationships. Rather, become more meditative in your relationships. Making love, let it be a meditation too. And you will be surprised. If while making love, you also move in a meditative state, you will have great insights what is happening. And the whole urge called sex will become conscious. And once it has become conscious, it can disappear. And it disappears on its own. You need not cultivate. You need not practice anything against it. When it goes on its own, it is beautiful. Yes, sex disappears. One transcends it. But not by fighting it. This is true, and because of this truth, much misunderstanding has happened in the world. Sex disappeared in Buddha's life. Sex disappeared in Christ's life. People have seen sex disappearing. And people have seen that when sex disappears, there is great splendor. Something of the sky dances on the earth. The beyond reaches to the earth. The mundane becomes suffused with the sacred. And because people have seen these things, great desire has arisen in them to transcend sex. But then, the whole thing goes wrong. They start fighting with it. It is a secret science. And if you don't move rightly, everything will go wrong. A man is told by a friend that he should pick a wife who is an economist in the kitchen, a lady in the parlor, and a prostitute in bed. They meet sometime after the bedding, and the friend asks if he is satisfied with his choice. Well, says the newlywed, I did what you said, but I guess I made a mistake somewhere. The woman I married turned out to be a prostitute in the parlor, a lady in the kitchen, and an economist in bed. Just a little mismanagement. Just a thing here and a thing there, misplaced, and everything goes wrong. Transcendence is never through repression. Transcendence is through understanding. Transcendence is through awareness. Just the other night, I was giving sannyas to a psychoanalyst, a beautiful man. I have given him the name Anand Vitakam. It means bliss beyond sex. And to him I said that if you become meditative while making love, you will come to know few immensely significant things. The first and the most significant thing is that when you are going into a deep orgasm, when the climax is happening, there is great joy, because in that moment sex disappears. Sex brings you to the orgasmic stage, and once its purpose is fulfilled, sex disappears. In the orgasmic state, there is no sexuality left in you. You are simply throbbing, and there is no desire. You are utterly here now. There is no future, no fantasy, nothing, no imagination. And when the orgasm happens, the man is alone. The woman may be there, but he is not aware of the woman. And the woman is alone. The man is there, but she is not aware of the man. Orgasm is individual. It is happening in the inside of the man. It is happening in the inside of the woman. The other has triggered it, but then the function of the other is finished. You are no more interested in the other. In the deep orgasm, you are simply inside yourself. And there is no sex in it. Hence bliss. And after a good orgasm, for hours you will feel very, very blissful. And for hours you will not think of sex again. The desire has left you. What has happened? If you are feeling blissful, the desire cannot be there. If the desire is there, bliss cannot be there. Desire and bliss are never together. And if you meditate deeply while making love, you will become aware that time disappears. At the peak, there is no time. Suddenly you are here now. Only then you know the meaning of here and now. Otherwise you are in the past or in the future. And when time disappears, mind disappears, because mind is another aspect of time, another name for time. Mind is past plus future. When there is no time, there is no mind. Just think, no mind, no time, no sexual desire, and there is great bliss. But people miss it because they are not alert about it. People go into lovemaking unconsciously, mechanically. Go consciously, mindfully, remembering what is happening, watching, remaining a witness. And that will release understanding in you. That will release awareness in you. And awareness is transcendence. And awareness is freedom. Enough for today.